author of the World War II novel, The Final Mission. This is a story based on the true story of his uncle, J.D. Jones, and the adventures he had during World War II. So it is a novel based on true events. So, Mr. Arnold, if you are ready, if you could read a little bit for us, and then we'll have conversation after.
Sure. Thank you.
Thank you.
I think I'll read from somewhere near the last section of the book, and it doesn't have a lot of action, but I think it does demonstrate a little bit about how the book makes you feel. Following the map she had memorized two nights earlier in the truck stop restroom, Elsa turned off the highway and headed southeast. She was working her way to the eastern shore of a large bay south of Rapid River. The road turned from pavement to asphalt, but soon the asphalt ended and only dirt remained beneath the tires of Elsa's Ford. The car rolled steadily but slowly on towards the second turnoff, which would take her even deeper into the uninhabited woods. After covering more than 6 miles, Elsa spotted the next turnoff. This much narrow road was no more than a wide path with only two tire ruts. High weeds grew between the ruts and rubbed the undercarriage of the car, creating an eerie sound breaking the stillness around her. Tall trees lined both sides of the road, growing just inches from either side. The branches overhung, obscuring the sun, turning the road into a dark, cold tunnel. Slowing down now to less than 5 miles an hour, she kept a careful lookout for the landmarks indicated on the map etched in her mind. She checked them off one by one as she passed. The first one she came to was a culvert that carried water from a brook, guiding it safely under the road. Then the second landmark came into view. A long abandoned and nearly dilapidated farmhouse stood on the left, with a maple tree growing through the front porch roof. The white paint which covered the wooden siding of the building's exterior had long ago given way to the elements. Greenish-gray mold now took its place, and the gutters along the massive porch's roof had all manner of vegetation sprouting from them. It was just as she had pictured it. She drove on even slower now. I'm close now. Yes, there's the final landmark. Elsa concentration intensified. What little sunshine remained was now nearly gone. It seemed as though nightfall was coming much too soon. I must find that entrance. Her mind was permeated by thoughts of what she would do if she missed the entrance. Then Elsa saw it on the right. Filled with relief, she eased the car on and then up the long neglected and nearly invisible driveway. At a little past five, Elsa parked the car in front of the garage, stopping several feet from the double-hung doors. She left the motor running, took the car out of gear, and set the parking brake. Stepping from the car with the door key from the envelope in one hand and a box of matches in the other, she walked along the side of the broken-down cabin until reaching the side door. The woods were quiet, the only sounds being the Ford's motor smoothly idling behind her and a few birds chirping in the nearby trees. She slipped the key into the old padlock. It fit perfectly and turned easily. Taking off the lock and swinging the hasp out of the way, she pushed the door open and stepped inside. The interior of the cabin was dark. Elsa lit one of her long wooden matches. Holding the match above her head, a large room came into view. She stepped inside further until she was standing in the large room. Beyond the far end of the room in which she now stood, the garage was faintly visible by the light of the match. Carefully, she moved towards the direction of the garage. There was no doorway into the garage. It was more like a continuation of a big room. Elsa walked slowly towards the garage, then stepped down onto its dirt floor. The garage was completely empty. There were no tools hanging on the walls, no workbench, absolutely nothing in there. Elsa headed for the double doors. Standing just in front of the doors, she lit a second match. The light revealed a long, thick wooden beam running across both doors. It was held in place by four support brackets which were mounted to the doors. These brackets held the beam in place, which in turn kept the doors tightly closed. She carefully took hold of the massive wooden beam and tried to lift it. It was very heavy, causing her to struggle, but she managed to get it off the brackets and onto the floor. She dragged it over and left it against the side wall. Elsa turned once again to the doors and leaned her shoulder firmly against one of the doors. She began to push as hard as she could. It gradually began to swing out, flattening the tall grass on the other side as it went. Light filled the room. Cobwebs hung from the rafters and clung to the doors and walls. The place was filthy. Grass had grown high and thick along the outside of the cabin, and now it was wedging the bottom of the door. No matter how hard she pushed, it refused to budge any further. Elsa squeezed her way through the small opening between the doors. Now standing outside, she took hold of the edge of the door, and with both hands, she struggled to push it open. Yanking and pulling all the way, the door finally stood open. She moved to the other door and did likewise. This one was even more difficult to budge, but it eventually began to move. In a weakened condition, it had taken nearly all of her strength to force the doors open wide enough to allow the car to pass through. Soon the car was safely concealed inside the building with the doors closed and the beam back in place. Elsa took the time to return to the driveway and kick the tall grass in front of the doors back up as straight as she could in an effort to erase any trace of her presence. She entered the cabin again from the side door, closed it behind her, and bolted it from the inside. By the light of another long match, she made her way back to the garage. Confident no one had been following, Elsa felt safe. The medicine wasn't helping. She craved rest, but the cabin was absolutely filthy. She climbed back in the car and lay down in the front seat. Tonight she would sleep in the car. Tomorrow she would deal with the dirt. When Elsa closed her eyes, she was asleep.
Okay. What is going on?
So Arnold, tell us a little bit. Give us just a quick synopsis of the book so that they can tie in the piece you read to the overall story.
Well, the book is about an uncle of mine who was a pilot of a B-25 Mitchell medium bomber in the Pacific in World War II. And he completed his missions out there after being shot down and marooned on an island, and moved back to the United States, where he had one mission to go. He did 44 missions. He didn't do his 45th out there. And since he had been marooned, they said, you're not doing any more out here, you're going to go on back. And there was one mission left. And that mission was for him to fly air cover over the aircraft carriers that were stationed on Lake Michigan, the USS Wolverine and the Sable. And some things happened, and the drones that we know of today were being tested Grand Traverse Bay, off these aircraft carriers. The goal was to attack Japan. This is before anybody knew about the atomic bomb, before it had been made public. And they were going to attack Japan with thousands and thousands of drones, television-guided, radio-controlled drones. And they had been being used in the Pacific regularly during the last 2 years of the war, but never off an aircraft carrier. So they redesigned a particular plane, developed it, and tested it here. And JD's final mission was to fly air cover over that. The lady there is a German spy who problem that everybody had was we trained over 17,000 aircraft carrier pilots with those two aircraft carriers without any interruption. And the Japanese couldn't stop us from building ships. The Germans couldn't stop us. So together they tied together to try to eliminate those two ships, to at least to stop the training of the pilots. And JD got in the middle of that without knowing it. And she was, this is the female, one of the female spies who was trying to get to the location where they were going to do something. And she was being tracked by the FBI at this time.
Uh-huh.
So the first part of that is the FBI tracking her. The second part is her fighting her way.
So, Barry, go ahead.
What you just said about the drones, there was an internet story I caught the other night, and I identified the B-25 Mitchell bomber in the picture, and it was about the U.S. testing the feasibility of drones at that time.
Well,
you just mentioned.
There you go. Okay.
Yeah.
So I recognized instantly what you said. So the technology, the idea, was that 75 odd years ago.
Isn't it amazing?
Isn't that
amazing?
Well, what they did, they had a joystick that they used, but they also, if they wanted to make a major turn, they used a telephone dial. Three numbers got you this many degrees, four numbers got you this many degrees. Amazing, huh?
The old-fashioned telephone.
Yeah, because that's all they had.
Yeah, so when we started working on this book together, I was very curious about this, because this is a mission I've never heard of. They don't teach you about World War II happening in Lake Michigan in high school. So
yeah, they didn't.
Yeah, they didn't. They don't teach you about that. Mm-hmm. So I went and spoke to my father about it, and his late wife, my stepmother, her first husband worked for Williams International, and he was on the team that actually built these drones. So I was able to see photographs of these drones. I don't know if I ever showed them to you, but we'll have to do that.
But nobody knew about this, and you know.
Yeah, it was a great big secret for years and years and years and years. So tell us about the connection and the research that you had to do with J.D. being your uncle. Tell us a little bit how you were able to piece together your family's connectivity to this story.
Well, the picture on the front of J.D. in the front cover here, that picture was in a frame on my grandmother's mantle. And when I was 3 or 4 years old, she had a fireplace that maybe an 8-year-old kid could walk into, big fireplace. I used to ask her, "Who's that? Who's that?" And she'd say, "Oh, that's your Uncle J.D. and just go on and on and on about wonderful things, but then change the subject. Never, all through our life, we never knew much about J.D. It was like, over there, look over there, you know, always. But he was, you could tell that everybody revered him very highly, but he never came around. He was never at any functions. And so finally, we all kind of gave up. And then when my dad was very sick with cancer and he had asked me to go with him down to Kentucky to a funeral, he shared this story with me for the first time, because the guy whose funeral we were going to was J.D.'s best friend, and they joined the National Guard together. And my dad says, we were sworn to secrecy. We have never spoken about this, but I don't think it'll hurt. So he told the story, and I thought, right, that did not happen. Because there's an element of treasure, and it goes all the way back to 1860. There's a section that goes back to 1862. And it's very interesting that J.D. gets involved in as well when he's marooned. So this story is got a lot going on, and I couldn't believe all of it happened. So when the internet came along a couple years later and I got myself a laptop, you know, I started dinking around and looking, and sure enough, I started putting these things together all over the world, at very events that happened. I says, how could my dad possibly have known about that unless it were true? So then I started to really, really research and get all the detail, until one day I just sat down and wrote the book, and I'd never written any more than a memo in my life.
Isn't that something?
So, because people ask me, you know, what would you recommend about if you want to write a book? You know, obviously you know how to structure a sentence. You fundamental, you got to know how to structure a sentence. You got to know what a prepositional phrase. You got to kind of know that stuff. Or it's going to be she'll get rich editing. but you got to have, if you got a story, tell it. If you got a story, tell it. Just, if you got a story, tell it. If you don't have a story, don't write. You know?
It's your family story.
Yeah. It's interesting, isn't it? I mean, it's very interesting.
How many years do you have to wait for the government to swear you to secrecy?
Well, they didn't know back. You know, they were told, you got to take this to your grave.
Yeah.
Do you understand?
So they did.
And so they did. They all just,
Yeah.
I mean, there was a war on, you know? Now, we talk about that in the, what's the last thing called? The prelude's the beginning. What's the last thing called?
Epilogue.
In the epilogue, discuss a little bit more about it. Okay.
Wow. The greatest generation, right?
Yeah, that's what, you know, people say they were the greatest generation, right?
Every one of those, they're in their 70s, 80s?
90s now.
90s now, yeah.
You know, they're interested, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
They have a lot of...
Well, I found it interesting that, I grew up, I was born in 1949, so I grew up, and everybody around me had served in World War II. Every father had served.
That's true.
And every mother had done something. So everybody there was carrying World War II marks of some type.
Yeah.
Okay? They all had the same kind of joint experience. They felt no need to talk about it.
You know,
They want to put it behind them.
It's been a lot of fun to represent this book because it is such a wonderful story to tell, and it really does place World War II veterans in a spectacular light.
Yes.
So, Arnold, other than the sequel to this book, do you have any other stories running around in your head that you think you might be writing?
I have a lot of stories.
Any that you can share publicly?
No. The reason I even thought about writing a book is because people say to me, you got to write a book. You got so many good stories. Because I can lie about anything. I can take a grain of truth and turn it into anything.
Make it a better story, yeah.
Yeah, and elaborate on it, and just keep going. So, yeah, I think that I've got quite a few things. And it's all something I did personally, something I saw.
Yeah.
And, almost like a Walter Mitty. You see something and you think about it, and all of a sudden you think about what it could be, and then it gets out there, and pretty soon there's a story.
Yeah.
And then you
try
it on people, right?
Yeah.
And you watch them, and you see they're just staring at you like, what's going to happen next?
Yeah.
You say, that's one.
Yeah.
That's one. It'll turn into a short story or a book, right? So I've got a few of those.
Excellent. Well, we will certainly be looking forward to the sequel to The Final Mission. Anyone who's interested in that can jump on our website, and we'll have updates as soon as they're available. So The Final Mission by Arnold D. Jones. Thank you so much for coming today and sharing this with us. And this book is available on Amazon for Kindle and, of course, through Gray Wolf Publishing. Thank you, Arnold.
Thank you.